When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Today's episode is presented by Meta.
A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating worldwide. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
When Europe really needed to be there for each other, too many initially looked out for themselves. When Europe really needed an all-for-one spirit, too many initially gave an only-for-me response.
Welcome to EU Confidential, the number one European politics podcast. I'm Andrew Gray in Brussels, and you just heard European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen speaking at an extraordinary session of the European Parliament on Thursday. Extraordinary in many ways, as most MEPs weren't in the chamber, but scattered around Europe, voting remotely for the first time. But even in this era of social distancing, the EU wouldn't be the EU without some late-night summit drama, and leaders delivered more of that by video conference this evening in what sounds like a bitter dispute over European solidarity, with Italy leading the calls for the EU to issue joint debt, so-called corona bonds, to help get Europe out of the crisis, and Germany and the Netherlands rejecting the idea. To veteran EU watchers, these are, of course, familiar fault lines. Later in the podcast, we'll hear from Gail Smith of development NGO The One Campaign on what we can learn from previous epidemics. But first, talking of veteran EU watchers, let's get views from across the continent with our podcast panel. Hi, first to Silvia Sciorilli-Borelli in Rome. Hi, Silvia.
Hi.
To Matt Karnichnik in Berlin. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
Annabel Dixon, still hiding out in Norwich, are you?
I am indeed. Hello.
Hi there. And Reem Momtaz in Paris. Hi, Reem.
Hello.
Sylvia, let's start with you. We had you on the podcast a couple of weeks ago when the very severe restrictions, you know, came in Italy. Obviously, Italy is the worst affected country now and, you know, has the highest death toll in Europe. In some ways, you're the sort of voice of the future because you're further along in terms of how the virus seems to have spread and in terms of the measures that have been taken. So, I mean, can you tell the rest of Europe, is there any sign that they are working?
Well, Conte yesterday addressed Parliament saying that he hopes every other European country gets on board and does exactly what Italy has done so far. In those places, in those small towns, especially where the lockdown measures have been implemented in February, the situation has improved.
Sylvia, how are Italian people feeling?
Well, it is terrifying. There is a sense that there is this black cloud over Italy and it's just not going anywhere. The death toll is scary. The fact that many doctors are falling ill is also concerning. The pace of the spread of the virus and also the number of people, especially in Lombardy, that are dying with a situation that is essentially out of hand, not just in hospitals, but even, you know, for families that can't even give their loved ones a proper burial is just taking, I think, a very, very big emotional toll on people throughout the country.
Yeah. And how are you doing personally, Sylvia? We talked to you a couple of weeks ago. We know you have a toddler at home and it's just the two of you at the moment. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm trying to cope as best I can. I've essentially given up on trying to keep things organized because it's impossible. You know, I try to work while looking after her and she's just starting to be a lion in a cage. She's acting like, you know, it's just hard to... It's hard. I don't know how else to explain it. We don't know when it'll end. And it's been 17 days now. She hasn't been going to school for 25 days. Our routine is completely messed up. My husband is in here, and as you were saying, we're alone. So we just cope. We hope it'll be over soon. I'm okay. Not thrilled, but okay, I guess.
Okay, well, we're glad to hear that at least. I just wanted to, one of the things I want to talk about more generally is the whole idea of how you remain a functioning democracy, or if you even can remain a functioning democracy in the middle of measures like this, where freedoms are restricted and a lot of the usual checks and balances, you know, can't really happen in the usual way. And we've got this extraordinary session of the European Parliament at the moment where most of the MEPs are not there. They're going to vote by some kind of convoluted procedure where they vote on paper and then take a picture of their vote. You know, it's all very strange. It is not normal, you know, parliamentary business as usual. And so I wondered, Annabel, how's the House of Commons, the House of Lords, how's Westminster dealing with this? You know, how to strike the balance between maintaining kind of democratic scrutiny, but also social distancing, travel bans, all of that?
They've been very keen to keep the Parliament open, and MPs have been travelling into Westminster from all over the country. They finally broke up for recess last night, Wednesday night, and they won't be back for a month. But there hasn't actually been some criticism that they've almost tried to keep things going as normally as possible and not really setting example to the rest of the country. So there's that balance between setting the example, but as you say, also holding the government to account. They're trying to keep the select committees going, which is unusual during recess. That doesn't usually happen. So they're trying to bring in video conferencing. And we, of course, had the coronavirus bill, which passed yesterday. That's those kind of emergency measures, things like cutting red tape to help the emergency services cope, restricting events, shutting down pubs, closing borders if needed. And there were people who were raising concerns about the sort of curb on liberties, which, you know, in any normal times, people would be horrified at some of the powers that this bill gives government. But the public mood is such that the opposition just had to say, no, we've got to back this, we've got to do this, we're doing it with a heavy heart. You know, there's no sign that the public wanted MPs to spend days and weeks debating this.
Matt, you've got the Bundestag there, you know, passing this extraordinary kind of extra budget, right? 150 billion euros or something. And it's all being done in the space of a week. So how's that kind of debate playing out there? You know, that's obviously not the normal parliamentary procedure. You know, how's Germany striking a balance? Is it a debate at all?
It's pretty extraordinary how quickly they managed to push this through, considering the years it took for them to debate much smaller sums over the Eurozone debt crisis. But the question is, how long can they continue along this path? And I think a lot of people here are already kind of asking that question. I mean, the German economy can't just be shut down, you know, for the rest of this year. And they're starting to wonder now, what is the exit strategy? And nobody seems to have a very good answer to that question, or even the question if everything that's being done now is a little bit overkill.
Reem, in Paris, how are they? You know, obviously Emmanuel Macron has a lot of power anyway as president under the Fifth Republic, but is there that debate about how they get the balance right between, you know, keeping democracy going but also dealing with this emergency?
There's definitely that debate, especially since Macron has been constantly, you know, attacked and accused since he became president of wanting to be more authoritarian than even the powers that the Fifth Republic give the president in France, which, as you said, are a lot. And today, in fact, on Thursday morning, the Minister of Justice in France was on public radio and was being asked about, you know, oversight. What happens to the judges? You know, is the judicial system still working? For example, the Constitutional Council is no longer going to be working as usual. And so the ability to sort of send cases up to the Constitutional Council is curtailed right now. And that's one of the oversight mechanisms that exists in France. This question of the Scientific Council and relying on scientific recommendations is also coming up a lot, because from the beginning, Emmanuel Emmanuel Macron has taken the strategy of always referring to the advice that the scientific council that he set up has been giving him and advising. But now another question is coming up, which is, well, who is answering? Is it 10 or 11, who is deciding? Is it 10 or 11 scientists who don't really have any democratic accountability and don't really have any democratic mandate? Or is it the president and the government who have a democratic mandate? And so now you're seeing an evolution in also that strategy where the president is now taking a bit more time, marking a bit of a time difference between the moment that the scientific council gives its recommendation and when he announces new decisions.
We've almost had this sort of debate in reverse because the sort of government strategy at the beginning seemed to be very economy focused in many ways. And I mean, he had kept insisting that the scientific advice was telling them that, you know, the time now wasn't to act. So they were waiting and waiting and waiting. And he was under this huge political pressure to do more. So we've almost kind of had the economic argument first. And the pressure has been such that now sort of almost health trumps economy with these kind of huge bailouts that the government keeps announcing.
I would just add a point on the economic aspect of this, which is that I think this is going to come to a head in the next couple of weeks, also at the European level, and we have the European Council meeting today, the virtual meeting in any case, and the Italian economy is coming under intense pressure already, and that will continue. And so then it's going to come down to Germany and France again deciding how far they're willing to go in terms of integration, in particular of the Eurozone. And there's this discussion now about Eurobonds, these, you know, so-called Corona bonds, which France supports, and a number of other countries have written to Charles Michel ahead of the meeting, pressing for some kind of instrument that would allow for mutualization of debt, as the economists call it. And this is something that the same countries wanted during the Eurozone debt crisis, and Germany and the Netherlands and other northern countries always said no. And I think there's going to be even more pressure now, because if this doesn't happen, the sort of divide between Southern Europe and Northern Europe in terms of the economic outlook is only going to widen. So, you know, this is not just a health crisis and an economic crisis in the sort of traditional sense. This could also very quickly turn into another crisis about the future of both the Eurozone and the European Union.
In Italy, there has been lots of talk about how Europe should intervene or support Italy more than it has so far. Unfortunately, this again has turned into a debate around, you know, how Europe is helping and whether Europe is helping. And the sense, the generalized sense, has been that Europe has not helped sufficiently so far, and this will be a make or break situation for Europe and Italy's role within the EU. There was some suggestion earlier this week that Germany would be open to Italy asking for the European Stability Mechanism's help, essentially the EU's bailout arm. But the Italian government, including Finance Minister Roberto Gualtieri, have pushed back against this idea. And in Italy, no one wants for an intervention of the European Stability Mechanism, and they do not want to end up like Greece. So essentially, this is going to be a very complicated discussion, and I think there will be a delicate balance that will need to be found, because Italy is the Eurozone's third biggest economy. It will need to borrow billions to support the economy, and it seems there are diverging ideas as to how this should happen.
There's a couple of very quick points on this from the French perspective. One, Macron has been very adamant from the beginning to send a very clear message, especially toward Italy in particular, that they will do, as he keeps saying, whatever it takes. And it was very important for Macron that other European leaders use the words whatever it takes, as we saw von der Leyen do, for example, because Macron is very aware that this crisis is, you know, after it's the third crisis that Europe is being really confronted with, after the debt crisis and then the migration crisis. And he's keenly aware that if Europe does not actually show up and step up and make sure that countries like Italy and others, you know, Spain and others don't feel like they are alone and abandoned by the rest, then it's going to be the end of Europe and the EU as he wants and as he imagines it to be. And on that, it's been very interesting to see just how badly the European countries have played the communication war. So you'll remember in January, the EU and France included, of course, sent 56 tons of medical aid to China when China was facing its you know, the height of its epidemic, its coronavirus epidemic. And the Chinese, I am told by multiple sources, that the Chinese government asked the Europeans not to make that public because they wanted to save face. And then what did the Chinese do? They turn around now and they constantly sort of show on television and on social media just how much they're helping the Italians when the Europeans aren't. And there's no question that, you know, the French and the Germans at the beginning did not deliver enough masks or any masks quick enough. But it has to be said that by now, France and Germany have delivered as much, if not more, masks and respirators to Italy. And unfortunately, they have not done a good job of making that public enough and countering, you know, the Chinese, the Cuban, the Russian sort of propaganda wars that they're waging on Europe. And that is also a part and a dimension of this crisis.
Yeah, I do think we're seeing that now. We saw Germany take a number of patients from France, from the Alsace region, and we saw other European countries do the same. The numbers are very small, but obviously the symbolism is significant. And that seems to be what was very much lacking in the early days, right? That, as you say, the communications, the message that we're there from you and here are some tangible ways we can show that we're there from you. That just didn't seem to be there, right? And as you say, others have taken advantage of that gap. Maybe we should just wrap up finally. Sylvia, do you want, you've been in confinement longest. Any tips for staying sane?
I've downloaded this part of this app called House Party, and I've been doing lots of video conferences with friends and my daughter's friends. I found that was useful. And also I've set up a few WhatsApp channels to share recipes and parenting tips with other friends and parents from my daughter's nursery. I found that really helped.
Cool. So you can have like virtual play dates. Does that work with your daughter?
It doesn't work very well. It doesn't work all the time. But, you know, if you put them on in front of an iPad, which is bigger than a phone, and they see their friends' faces, I've found they're interested, and it does keep them busy for a few minutes at least. Not like it saves my day, but, you know, it's something we look forward to every day, and it's helping.
Every minute helps. Yeah,
exactly.
Matt, what are your tips for staying in the bunker?
Oh, I'm not in the bunker. We're fortunate that we're not, you know, on the same kind of lockdown as other countries appear to be. So you can still go on walks in the park and that type of thing. Which,
yeah, we can do that too. It's true, we can do that. But I think
kept me sane, got me away from my kids.
Yep, just keep your distance, social distancing. That's important.
I don't have a problem with that anyway.
It's probably on both sides. It's a good arrangement. Reem.
One is it's really important to actually change into normal clothes and not stay in your pajamas all day and give yourself sort of a sense of structure in your day, almost like you were going to the office. And the other thing is, the past week, actually, I've been thinking a lot about perhaps people who are less fortunate than a lot of us. For example, people who live in violent homes, people who live with violent partners, and just how difficult the current confinement in France, where you can only go out once a day for barely an hour for 1 kilometer around your home. And actually, I've noticed that this has also come up with a lot of government officials I've been talking to. And in fact, they made an announcement a couple of days ago on television for a helpline that people suffering from this kind of domestic abuse or, you know, alcoholic partners can call to get some help. Now, I'm not exactly clear on, you know, whether that means they can actually leave the house and go seek shelter somewhere else. But I think, you know, if someone who's listening to us may be in that kind of position or know someone in that position, they should know that there are some resources that are being put in place on the internet, at least, and on helplines.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing that has been flagged as a possible consequence of this, that, you know, there are lots of people who are not as fortunate as us in terms of the household they live in and the effect that this kind of confinement could have. Okay, well, we've talked for a long time. Christina, as ever, is going to have to try and boil it down to something comprehensible, but she'll do her, you know, a top job as usual. Shall we call it quits there? Thanks, everybody. Cheers.
Thank you. Bye.
Now let's hear from someone who knows a lot about major epidemics and what it takes to fight them. Gail Smith, CEO of the One Campaign. She was in Brussels a few weeks ago, where she spoke to our reporter Lily Beyer. Hi, Lily.
Hi.
Kind of strange days. I mean, normally today, you and I and the rest of the Brussels politics team, and in fact, a lot of the political newsroom, would be in the European Council building along with hundreds of other reporters covering a full-scale EU summit, which is now taking place virtually in a kind of reduced form. Does feel kind of strange, doesn't it?
Very strange.
Yeah. But we wanted to bring our listeners an interview that you actually recorded a few weeks ago. And it's funny that time moves in strange ways these days. And obviously, we were doing interviews, recording things for the podcast before coronavirus kind of overtook everything. And we wanted to bring a flavour of that interview, especially as this one also covers coronavirus. So you were talking to Gail Smith of the One Campaign. Just explain who she is and a bit about what the One Campaign is and does.
So Gail Smith is the CEO and president of the One Campaign, which is an advocacy organization that tries to raise awareness and fight extreme poverty and disease. They do a lot of work in the developing world and especially in Africa. And Gail Smith's background is actually quite fascinating, because she is the former administrator of the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. So she has a lot of experience on the other side, on the policy side, as a US official dealing with the developing world.
Right. As we said, we recorded the interview a few weeks ago, and it's interesting. We talked about, or you talked about, a variety of things, but you did also talk about the coronavirus at a time when it was really just starting to make its impact felt in Europe. Anything in particular, you know, strike you about what she said?
So what's interesting is that Gail Smith was in town, I think, mainly to talk about the EU budget, because what the One Campaign cares about a lot is the EU's overseas development spending. And at the time, leaders were really deeply involved in this mega negotiation over the bloc's 2021 to 2027 spending. But Smith does have a lot of experience dealing with the implications, especially in the developing world, of diseases as a former U.S. official. So it really struck me how she put the current crisis in a historical context and talked about the processes that need to be in place.
I do think the international community is having to exercise the muscles that we're going to need increasingly in the future of how do you manage global disease threats. And this is a real one. And while the risk and lethality are relatively low, I think the urgency of it is quite real. And what I hope governments will do, in addition to putting out factual public information and testing and tracing and containment and treatment and all of those things, the search for a vaccine, is take note of the opportunity we've got to complete the building of the global architecture we need to manage these kinds of disease threats. We made progress after Ebola. You know, one of the things we discovered in the Ebola response is the world was very, very ill prepared for a lethal epidemic like Ebola. You know, the availability of the suits that practitioners had to wear. The Ebola treatment unit, which actually was pretty much invented and created from the initiative of the NGO community rather than governments. Our ability to move infected people who, that was at biosecurity safety level 4. A lot of those things were put together of necessity. They weren't necessarily all waiting in warehouses for when this happened. And I think the good thing that happened in the immediate aftermath is there was recognition that we needed to build surveillance capacity, laboratory testing capacity, get more governments to honor their commitments to meet what are called the international health regulations, which is the sort of regulatory system that says if we have a lethal disease here, we'll share samples, all those kinds of things. But then people lost interest. It's like, well, okay, let's move on to the next thing. And so now we've got this new, less lethal, but definitely global virus that is teaching us that, you know, walls don't matter, go anywhere, equal opportunity virus. And I think it's exposing the strengths, but it's also exposing the holes in the system. And so my measure of how we respond to this is kind of in two parts. One is, what's the response now? Are we iterating and learning? Because you learn something new every day in these things about contagion periods and incubation and all those things. But are we then also putting in place the things we need? Because this is a dry run. I mean, this is a warning shot. We all know this is going to happen with greater frequency. And we've got to have the regular or the regular systems in place to manage it. Yes, it'll be crises, it'll be urgent, but we can't reinvent how we respond each time. We gotta get down. So I think that's one of the things to look for.
It's fascinating.
It is. It is. And again, I think some of the response has been very good, but we can tighten it. And we're smart enough. You know, the only... again, at a time when there are a lot of people questioning the utility of multilateralism, this is a reminder, whether you like it or not, that virus is going to pay no attention to whether you're in the G7 or the G77 or whether you like the UN or you don't. They're going to go after everybody. So how do we build that system together more effectively?
That was Gail Smith of the One Campaign talking about the coronavirus. But as you say, Lily, she was in town to talk about the EU budget, which is a matter that still remains to be resolved. This is a new budget that's meant to kick in at the start of next year. And what's her focus there? What's her ask from the EU in terms of development funding and how that plays into the next budget?
So the One Campaign is focusing on a part of the budget, the proposed budget, that is known as the Neighborhood Development and International Cooperation Instrument. Under a proposal put forward by the European Council's President Charles Michel earlier this year, this section of the budget, which focuses on overseas aid, would get about 75.5 billion euros. But at this point, with the coronavirus crisis raging, I think it's pretty clear that the budget debate that we had just a few weeks ago will be a very different one once we come out of this crisis. So it's really hard to tell how much money EU leaders will be willing to put toward overseas development aid when this crisis is over, and when they'll be wanting perhaps to focus more inward on helping Europe recover.
From your conversation so far with people who are involved in the budget debate, can you give us a sense so far of how you think it's changing as a result of the coronavirus?
People are beginning to realize, you know, diplomats that we talked to and other officials, that this is going to be a huge dilemma, because the EU is already a bit behind schedule when it comes to deciding, signing off on the next budget. And now they're falling even more behind. And at a time when leaders publicly are talking about the need for the EU to invest more in order to help the economic recovery once this crisis is over or nearly over. So it is a huge problem. On the one hand, leaders don't have the time to negotiate a new budget, but also they really need that budget in place in order to implement things that they're promising to their citizens.
Right, we heard Charles Michel talking about a Marshall Plan, a new Marshall Plan, and talking about the EU budget being somehow part of that. Another point I think you picked up is, of course, if this has a big effect on the EU economy, as we expect it will, then suddenly when you're talking about, normally the budget debate is done in terms of percentage of gross national income, right? The kind of economic measure of each country. But if those number, if those economies are going to shrink, then the numbers shrink too, right?
Absolutely. I think right now in a lot of capitals, there must be some financial experts sitting down, recalculating and taking a totally fresh look at their positions on the EU budget. Because with smaller economies, with a possible recession, some countries may not want to contribute as much as they had originally planned to the EU budget, while others may be vying for a bigger budget because they think that they can get more out of it. But yeah, there's a lot of recalculating going on right now.
Indeed. And we'll stick with it and follow it wherever it goes. Lily, thanks very much. And that's all we have time for on this episode of EU Confidential. If you enjoyed the podcast, we'd encourage you to rate it by clicking some stars and by writing a review. You can also email us at podcast@politico.eu. We'll be back on Monday with another special episode focused on Europe's response to the coronavirus. In the meantime, thanks to our producer, Christina Gonzalez, and wherever you're listening, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.